Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If the only time you think about green technology is when the news reporters bring up the billions of federal dollars lost by Solyndra or the latest discussion of renewable energy, then you're not going back far enough by a long shot. Alexis Madrigal, senior editor at The Atlantic, has written a book on the topic of the forgotten history of green tech innovators long before it was sexy or regarded with suspicion. Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology, just came out in paperback, and Alexis Madrigal joins us from Washington, D.C. to talk about it. Welcome back to the show, Alexis.
Hey, thank you, Ann.
So when did it occur to you that there was an ancient history to green technology?
Well, you know, I actually have done a lot of digging on various historical and technology-related topics, and so I went to the Library of Congress website. It's called American Memory, and I typed in solar. This is in like 2006, 2007, and only one thing came up that had anything to do with solar power. I mean, this is, of course, a time when green is incredibly hot, and you realize that there was almost no historical memory except for this one item. Happened to be a solar hot water heater that had been put in the desert in California in the 1920s. And the caption said, you know, one of the last remaining solar hot water heaters from an industry that boomed in the early part of the 20th century. And I was like, the solar hot water industry boomed in the early part of the 20th century? Like, no one had any idea. Except for a few people during the 1970s had started to kind of excavate these origins. And if you look at old photos of, say, Pasadena, like 1905, you'll find dotting lots of roofs like you see now in China and Israel where solar hot water is a very big deal. You'll see little tanks and you'll see little what look like solar panels, but really what they are kind of there's water running through them. They're not like the photovoltaic arrays that you see now. And it was kind of at that moment when I realized that there were kind of two stories going on. I mean, one is this sort of loss of this just, you know, information about our past. And the other is, you know, why did these things not work out? What was it the technology? Was it societal constraints? Was it that fossil fuels got really cheap? And there are a lot of these different questions that I realized basically hadn't been explored. And certainly hadn't been explored at all since basically about 1980. And that's when I decided to do the book.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And I'm talking with Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior writer for The Atlantic. We've spoken with Alexis before, but this time it's about his book, Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. It just came out in paperback. If you have a question or comment for Alexis, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So for the purpose of the book, Alexis, how did you define green technology? What were your parameters?
Right. And it's a really tough question. I mean, it's one of those things where at first what seems like a useful brand perhaps starts to seem like unwieldy and too complicated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as it succeeds, it's sort of one of the penalties of success. But for my book, I looked at green technology as basically being low carbon or no carbon electricity generation. So I have a few chapters like on what happened with electric cars, which were a legitimate competitor to internal combustion engines at the beginning of the 20th century. But mostly I focused on how do you make electricity without burning fossil fuels? And that has less to do with like thinking about that's the only thing in green technology, and more to do with you're covering a bunch of technologies, you're covering 150 years, you got to draw the line somewhere. And that to me is sort of the big challenge. And I also included energy efficiency just because it's sort of if you have to burn less fossil fuels, that seems like a good thing as well.
So is that where like the vice grip fit in?
Is that where, excuse me?
The vice grip? Didn't you do a little thing about the vice grip?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I did. Well, you know, mostly I have a little riff on the 1970s in general, where I talk about kind of that there were all these different groups, you know, before the 1970s, and in particular before the oil embargo, you know, most people just counted on the utility to get them their electricity. They didn't really think about it much. And it was sort of within the sort of professional domain of these expert utility people. And it was only during the 70s that you saw these new groups of people coming to energy with all these different expectations. So on the one hand, you had physicists who were sort of like let's use the old science of thermodynamics to compute what the minimum possible energy input to a building to keep it warm is, right? Then you had people who were pure play technologists. A lot of them worked with the oil companies actually to develop solar photovoltaics. Then you had kind of the people everyone remembers, these like hippies who were into transcendentalism. They believed that using energy from the sun and other kinds of natural energies would actually make them better or different people. It's kind of quasi-religious in nature. And then, of course, there's sort of one of my groups, sort of the favorite, which are the tool makers. I mean, these were people kind of associated with the hippies, but a completely different set. They were largely clustered around the Whole Earth Catalog, which actually won the National Book Award and sold, I think it ended up selling over 1 million copies. This was a book that was put together by Stuart Brand, and their emphasis wasn't on transcendentalism, wasn't on making yourself like a better person through this sort of thing. They were interested in tools, things that worked really well. And one of the difficulties of green technology for that particular group and for a lot of activists around solar energy in the 1970s is that you need the technology to get better. It's not like pliers. It's not like a hammer, where like we're pretty much at the end of the line in the evolution of the hammer. When it comes to photovoltaic panels or wind machines, you need them to get a lot better. And in order to do that, you sort of need corporations and you need big government in a lot of cases to pay for the research and the research programs and the infrastructure and the organization. Just like we've done for all sorts of other things, from airlines to the space program to all kinds of biotechnology and medicine. These sorts of complex technological systems and solutions require a lot of complexity, and it sort of frustrated people who wanted it to be simpler.
How far back did you decide to go? I guess when you put it in the parameters of another way, a low carbon or no carbon electric generation, that's one thing, but how far back?
Right. Well, I took one liberty, which was if you weren't generating electricity, but you were generating power that was no carbon, then that was also okay.
So an alternative.
So one thing that I did is I went back to Lowell, Massachusetts, which, in the kind of early to mid 19th century was a place that, like, if you were to visit, say you were coming from France, as people did to tour, the New World, they'd go to like Boston, New York, and then Lowell, Massachusetts. And so when I saw that, I was like, well, why was this going on? And really, a lot of it has to do with that was one of the two seats of American manufacturing. It's where we made a lot of textiles. And we made those textiles with clean power. It was not necessarily green in a lot of ways, like in some of the other ways. It wasn't natural. There were big dams put in, and those dams were used to power the machines that made the cloth. And in fact, people like Thoreau, kind of some of the heroes of the environmental movement, thought that these dams were in fact bad. But I actually use Lowell as a good example of how these things could work, particularly relative to the other seat of American manufacturing in Pittsburgh, which Pittsburgh was like incredibly dirty. It was, the soot covered everything. It's actually difficult for people to think about how bad it was. But if you think about those pictures that we see of like Chinese cities now, where they're just covered with this blanket of soot and smoke, I mean, that was basically Pittsburgh. I mean, people used to talk about going into where Three River Stadium is now and seeing that valley as like entering like the mouth of hell. I mean, because there's all these fires burning things in order to make iron and eventually steel. And it was just it was a really tough place to live. Meanwhile, in Lowell, you had just that, and not to mention there's tons of environmental damage that was going on because of that. And meanwhile, in Lowell, you had some native fish stock suffering, but largely just outside the city, you were able to have pretty healthy ecosystems, yet healthier people as well.
You made a quick distinction there earlier, natural versus green. And natural versus good.
Yeah,
and that comes up a lot during the discourse about all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm sort of like a post-natural environmentalist. There's like a group of people who call themselves that. You know, I guess the way I see our world, particularly in light of climate change, is just that, you know, the problems are with human systems, and we need to like fix them at the level of human systems, and we've got to stop pretending that nature is like the only goal that, you know, promoting more nature is the only goal that environmentalists can have. Because in fact, you know, if you want to remake the entire way that we travel and the entire way that we make power and use power, you need to have a really different movement than a movement that sort of buys land and sets to the side, or that promotes sort of natural work. And I love hiking. I mean, I go, you know, I live in California, generally speaking, and I go hiking almost every day. I love nature, but I think of it as a different thing. I think of the goals that I'm interested in promoting in like my work are much more about understanding the kind of trade-offs that we have to make when it comes to changing the energy system. And one of those trade-offs is that, you know, renewable energy technologies take up a lot of space. They take up land out in the desert if you want to put big solar farms in. They take up land in the Midwest if you want to put in lots of wind turbines. And that means, in some cases, that what are perceived to be more natural surroundings are going to be changed into more mechanized surroundings where you can see machines there. And I guess, at least to me, that seems like an okay environmental trade-off.
The trade-off being necessary because we have billions of people to house, to feed, to clothe, to take care of now.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I guess an assumption that I'm making, or like one of my tenets, is just that like it's okay to promote people as like, and like the material well-being of people as like a positive thing. I think going back into the history of the environmental movement, I think a lot of people see the environmental movement as being about, you know, just like saving the whales, right? I mean, a lot of these things, saving the rainforest, and there's not really space for people in that. People are seen as an intrusion into this otherwise awesome natural world, and I guess I just don't see things that way. And I think if you go back and you see like when the environmental movement was having these incredible successes, I mean, getting Richard Nixon to sign all the environmental legislation basically is an incredible victory for a social movement. But if you look at who was powering it, it wasn't just people who were dedicated to the land. In fact, there's been some great work by Adam Rome, historian, who has shown that one of the big forces were actually a lot of suburban moms, because as they were moving out to the suburbs, out of the cities, they were seeing that right outside the cities and in their very communities, water quality was getting really bad. And when the water quality got bad, they started worrying about their kids. You know, it wasn't about protecting nature as such. It was about wanting clean groundwater so that their children would be safe. And I think it's those kinds of concerns that ultimately end up powering a lot of successful environmental activism.
My guest is Alexis Madrigal, senior writer for The Atlantic and the author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. It's just out in paperback. If you have a question or comment for Alexis, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and your annual support is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news you listen to every day. It's easy to renew your membership. Just visit wosu.org/renew, call 866-897-9678, or respond to our mailing by sending a generous check. Your annual gift provides the foundation of listener support. Thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News. And it's 35 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today warming up to a high of 45. Increasing clouds tonight, a low of 32, and rain is expected throughout the day on Tuesday, a high of 42, more rain Tuesday night, a low of 38 degrees. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Alexis Madrigal. We're right talking about his book. It's just out in paperback now. It's called Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have a question or comment for Alexis. Wind plays a big role in the story. It's always with us, after all. Can't get rid of wind, no matter, you know, whereas you can use up a lot of other natural resources, that and sun are always with us, hopefully.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. Wind plays an interesting role in the book because it's become the most successful renewable energy technology in terms of sort of how much there is installed in the U.S., which is a lot of what I was focusing on. And there's some great history to it. I think, wind is one of those things that has been used in a lot of different ways. And there's a couple of great stories, particularly from the Midwest. So you have these people who are moving across the country, right? And
the pioneers.
The pioneers, yeah. They're heading across west, and they keep pushing further and further west. And eventually they get to, the 100th parallel, and it gets pretty dry out west of that. And so one of the key technologies in allowing the sort of country to be pieced together by these settlers is that they could use wind to pump water. And so there actually was a technology called the American windmill that sort of auto-regulated itself. That is to say, like, it had a vane that would push it into the wind until the wind got too strong, and then it would push it away from the wind. And that allowed all kinds of things to happen. The railroads, for example, needed water for their steam engines. And so the railroads were the really good early customers for a lot of the innovators around windmill technology, just because they needed it badly and they needed big versions. And so they were a good customer. But a lot of farmers, particularly in Nebraska and Kansas, really dry places, they didn't have money to go buy one of the fancy sort of railroad style windmills, or even what people in the cities of these places could afford to buy. And so they just built theirs out of whatever they had. And so there's a great story. This guy who was actually a dinosaur bone hunter named Irwin Barber, kind of a Yale guy who went out to Nebraska to become the state's state geologist, and like was always hunting dinosaur bones. So he's crisscrossing the state, and he's noticing that all of these different places have their own style of windmill. So if you have been traveling the small towns of Nebraska at the turn of the century, you would have seen all these crazy-looking contraptions which were all able to capture the wind to greater or lesser extent. And one of the great things is that it was really cheap and it was wonderful, but one of the bad things was it wasn't easy for like good knowledge to spread. And it's one of the interesting lessons about innovation in this book is that it's awesome to have a bunch of different, flowers blooming everywhere, but if they can't cross-pollinate, it's difficult for the technology to get better faster. And I think that's something that, particularly in the 1970s, became a problem. You had all these people who were working on, alternative energy technologies, and they wanted to do things at a really small scale. At the scale of the commune or the scale of their house. Mm-hmm. And that made it difficult to have sort of productive discourse because you didn't have a lot of people involved. The networks for information travel were not good. And that actually contrasts really sharply in a lot of ways with what happened with fossil fuels, where just because of the nature of the commodity, there were these entities, corporations, that organized to take advantage of that, and that allowed them to cover a lot more ground, and they were able to improve the technologies much more quickly. And I think that's the sort of portability of fossil fuels is really underrated in terms of like putting together networks of people who are all learning these different kinds of things, something that even now we're seeing happen again with fracking, where knowledge about how to extract natural gas and oil out of kind of geologies that we previously couldn't it has spread pretty quickly and now spreading globally, and it's really changed the energy picture for a lot of communities.
I kind of like the irony of the fossil hunter noticing the variations on the theme of the windmill.
Oh, it's a great. He wrote a book about it, which is available online. Actually, the USGS scanned it. The Geological Survey scanned it, and you can see all the different people, and they're sort of standing out in their farm,
kind of like quilts, right?
Yeah. Oh, totally. There was total regional style and variation, and sadly, basically none of them survived. They were all they're all jerry rigged and built out of wood. You know, they're rotting in fields everywhere, I'm sure. So you know, the kind of ones that you see, they usually say air motor on them, A-E-R motor. Those ones came later, and they were also, those were kind of like the store-bought version. But there were ones that looked kind of like, you ever see those old-school water mills? There were ones that looked like that. There were ones that sort of rotated horizontally around an axis.
Yeah.
There were ones called the battle axe that sort of like, if you were to like move your arms like you were dancing the robot, sort of, they kind of move like that. This is all going on kind of the 1890s. And these people, had a lot of experience with the wind. And I think that one of the sad things about this history being lost is that, if you were to be building support for green technology in this country, you would presumably want to go to people like that and be able to say, hey, this is like part of our history. This is part of your heritage, part of who we are as Americans. Like, we came up with the American windmill, which, ended up selling to 6 million units in its time. So it was like, aside from the oven and before the car, it was like the most successful personal power technology out there. And that sort of stuff just kind of never has really entered the conversation. And so instead, I think particularly in the green movement, people have looked to environmental forebears. They've looked to people, Thoreau is also a writer for The Atlantic. I like him a lot. But also, he doesn't have a lot to say about green technology, and yet he is one of the kind of leading lights for environmental groups still.
Ed, in Baltimore, you're on the air. You remember the old Pittsburgh, right?
I sure do. That's a comment, and then I have a question just to follow up on that. When I was at a high university in the early 70s, I met some people from Pittsburgh, and one year their father came down and picked us up and took us up to Pittsburgh for the weekend in Thanksgiving. And as we turned north out of Washington, Pennsylvania, going north toward Pittsburgh, he said, "See that cloud up there? That's Pittsburgh. You won't see the sun until we get back on the way south back to school again." Secondarily, I wanted to ask, since he talked about clean water, I know back in the early 70s, there was the first talk about acid rain. Mm-hmm. And I remember that distinctively, talking about the upper New York State and New England, a lot of the lakes and ponds. Certain fish were not being able to propagate anymore because the pH of the water had changed. And I wanted to know if he has any information about how that has changed since we put more restrictions on the coal-fired plants and the steel plants and things like that that used to spew all that stuff into the air. And I'll listen on the radio.
All right. Thank you, Alexis.
Cool. Yeah. Well, two things. So just to address the anecdote, which is a great anecdote. If you go and you just Google like Pittsburgh smoke nuisance lantern slides, like L-A-N-T-E-R-N slides, you'll see that I think it's the University of Pittsburgh has put together a collection of what Pittsburgh looked like before regulations cleaned that place up. And what's amazing about it is their captions are actually written on the photos. And it says like, 5th and Main, noon, and all the lights are on. All the cars have their lights on. When it was a bad air quality day, there was so much smoke in the air that literally it was nighttime. All the time. I mean, this is like an incredible thing. I mean, it has to do in part by the type of coal that was being burned. And that type of coal tends to be softer and sootier. So that's part of it. Not all coal has that same impact.
Mm-hmm.
But it's truly a remarkable thing to see and to realize that that's that's in our parents' and grandparents' like living memory. That's not something that, you know, when we look at China and we're like, how could they let their cities be like that? I mean, well, you know, our parents and grandparents let their cities be like that. It's not outside of living memory. As for the water quality question, mm-hmm. It's not as much my specialty, but I think the kind of key point, and the key point particularly as it related to my work, was that when regulations were put in place to basically scrub the SOx and NOx, these sort of like particles that were being emitted that were bad for acid rain purposes, it actually turned out that relative to the projections of the industry at the time, it was much cheaper to get rid of them than people thought. And this is kind of a theme that runs throughout my book, that the projections that people in industries make have tended to be pretty bad when they're talking about their own industry. And that's sort of a general point. But in energy, they're sort of like particularly, especially spectacularly bad. And I'll just give one example. In the kind of mid-20th century, people were using a lot more electricity every year. I mean, so, you know, you had electricity demand going up like 8 or 9% per year, in part because electricity is awesome. Everyone likes electricity. There's like it's so part of our lives that we sort of forget that, but then the power goes out and you realize how much you like electricity. But it was also part of a big marketing program by a lot of the utilities to get people to use more electricity. And in fact, there's a famous quote by a guy named Philip Sporn, who's one of the big engineers of in power in the 20th century, who said, you know, the loads that are most important are the loads that we invent. And so in some cases, what that meant was like pushing out lots of air conditioning maybe faster than it would have gone, and then realizing that that air conditioning gave them a big peak in the summer. And so they wanted to balance that out with a peak in the winter. And so they started putting out electric heaters, which turn out to be one of the worst ways of heating a space that you can possibly imagine, incredibly inefficient way of doing it. And so you had this massive rise in electricity as a result of all these factors. But then eventually it stopped. And so the projections that people made in the middle of the century by basically across the board, like there's actually a conference where someone says, basically every projection says this. And so therefore everyone assumed it must be true. And really what they were projecting is that our current power system with all the problems that it has would be twice as big. So all, you know, for every car on the road, there'd be another car. For every building, there'd be another building. For every power plant, there'd be another power plant. They're projecting that the use of energy, and in particular the use of electricity, was going to just skyrocket in a way that it just did not. And in fact, the only people who actually made decent predictions during that time were people who were considered totally nutso environmental types who were making these lowball projections that would ruin the entire world and send us back into the dark ages. And so I think it's just important. It's not that, you know, that doesn't mean environmentalists now are the only ones making good projections, but it's just worth remembering that oftentimes we think, oh, well, the people in industry are the ones who have the best data, or the people in industry are the ones who know the best. And that's occasionally true, but oftentimes a projection is actually about the present. It's about arguing for something they want to do now. It's a rhetorical move. It's not actually about telling you what, you know, demand is going to look like in 2050. It's about what their, you know, what the political situation should be in 2013.
Andy in Columbiana County, you're on the air with Alexis Madrigal. Welcome.
Howdy. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
I have a couple quick questions. The first one is, you heard anything about wave interference in order to provide superheated water? And the other is about using heat directly to electricity.
On the wave interference, I haven't. There's a lot of energy technologies that are sort of, you know, in the very early stages, and I haven't heard of that one. As far as heat directly to electricity, thermoelectric generators have existed for a long time. They were actually one of the early ways that NASA got electricity, was to basically put like a little heat-generating radioactive isotope somewhere, and then using the heat from that They'd run it through a thermoelectric material, which takes the heat and spits out electrons, and they use it like that. So it's something that we've had for about as long as we've had photovoltaic panels. And those are the kind of solar panels most people know. They take photons, they take light, not heat, and convert that directly into electricity. On the thermoelectric side, directly converting heat to electricity, I think there's a couple of really exciting things. I mean, one, material science right now, just like, you know, material science in the early 20th century was a huge deal. Basically, making better steel allowed us to have bigger power plants, which allowed us to drive down the price of electricity, which was a really good thing. And now you see all different kinds of materials, this kind of resurgence of material science, because we're able to do a lot more of the sort of calculations and just the math, like on computers, rather than having to run experiments actually like, you know, with physical materials. And so I think there are definitely people out there, chemists in fact, who think that in the long run, thermoelectric conversion is going to be better than photoelectric conversion, than these sort of photovoltaic panels that we have. But of course, you know, the technology is in really different places. And so right now it looks like where they might catch on would be in places where they're called like heat scavenging, there might be some industrial processes or other things that generate a lot of waste heat, and you could capture some of that and feed it back to the plant. And that, you know, that seems like a reasonable thing. And it's the kind of, I mean, you know, the funny thing is, I think this is sort of a general lesson here. I mean, there's a lot of pieces of green technology that actually are adopted by industry just as like kind of part of like a normal efficiency operation. And it's one of those things that kind of flies under the radar, this kind of heat scavenging or making things more efficient. But so many of our industries have actually gotten incredibly energy efficient because they're big users of power. And if you're a big user of power, that means it's a big part of the cost of your business. And so you work to minimize those things. And I think, you know, I do sort of wish that people were more aware of that and more aware and considered it to be part of green technology, because it kind of makes the tent a lot bigger. And it sort of allows more people to play a role.
Makes me think of Sauer Woodworking. It's a big company up in northern Ohio, and they used to throw away all of their sawdust.
Yep, and now they're using it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right, exactly. There's a lot of, you know, one of the reasons that ethanol, which is, you know, a fuel that you can put into cars, obviously, one of the reasons that the Brazilian plants that use sugarcane are so much more efficient than the ones that we have that use corn is that they have the waste products are able to be turned into other things, largely power by burning it. Yeah.
My guest is Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior writer for The Atlantic. You've heard him on the show before. Today we're talking about his book, Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. It is now out in paperback, and we'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the call for federal investment in new manufacturing innovation hubs across the country. Would they make the U.S. more competitive? Should we spend the money? Where? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and a discussion of artist Mark Rothko, whose life and work are a part of something happening in Columbus right now. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 35 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today with a high of 45, increasing clouds tonight with a low of 32 degrees, rain expected for Tuesday and a high of 42. For everyone suffering from Downton Abbey withdrawal, tonight on WOSU-TV, watch The Secrets of High Clear Castle. Learn the true story behind one of the world's most famous homes, Highclere Castle in England, which gained fame as the backdrop to Downton Abbey. Explore the history of the castle and learn how many of the events played out on TV are based on true tales from Highclere's past. Watch The Secrets of Highclere Castle. It's tonight at 10 on WOSU-TV. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior writer for The Atlantic and author of the book Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Don in Mechanicsburg, you're on the air. Mechanicsburg is kind of an ironic name for a city there. Hey, Don, how you doing?
Not bad, thank you.
Good.
Great day.
Yeah.
My solar system is running. I'm getting all kinds of hot water.
Oh, great.
A sunny day here today.
Yes, for a change.
Yeah.
I wanted to really express my appreciation for the work done on this book, because people tend to forget the problems we've had and which we still seem to have. But one of the difficulties I face as an energy specialist is that people simply don't believe that what we're doing can be done. We have buildings that run on 5% of the energy of other buildings like around them, and people don't believe it can be done. They say it's too cloudy here, but it is possible.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, I think this kind of disbelief goes back a long way. You know, the solar hot water systems I was talking about at the top of the show. I mean, one of the things that they used to do in California was to literally almost burn people with how hot the water was. That was the demonstration. It was almost seen as like, the only way people will understand this is we can actually make them feel little pain through the heat of the sun. And I don't think that's actually a good marketing technique, but it was what they did at the time. And I mean, one thing, and this is a bit of hope that I have. I'm actually talking to a facilities management group tomorrow. And one thing that I'm talking to them about is I feel like a lot of buildings are getting instrumented. They're getting sensors put on them in all kinds of places. And a lot of the effort there is dedicated to thinking about their energy consumption, monitoring. And I think when you see that become a more widespread practice, I think it might be the kind of thing that changes the way people – that changes, like, people's thoughts about what's possible. Because if they're able to see with their own eyes that, you know, oh, yeah, actually similar buildings in the same climate, in the same place, and one of them is completely outperforming the other building, I think that's going to be a really big – I think it's going to be a really big thing. I mean, one of the other sort of subterranean problems here is that people who operate buildings have a pretty good sense of how they work and how well they work and what kind of energy efficiency they have. But there's kind of a broken feedback loop back into people who are designing those buildings. So, you know, some data came out of New York, which had passed a law that required that big buildings monitor their energy, you know, like big New York big buildings. And what they found was that the LEED buildings weren't even necessarily – LEED is this green building standard that's existed for a while – we're not really outperforming the old buildings, which I feel like I probably should have run with more, given that my book is about the history of green technology. But there's an interesting lesson there, I think, which is that a lot of the simulations that we've done, a lot of the things that we think work, might not, and it's difficult to know how well a building is going to perform before it's actually working and operating, and the people who are operating it, you know, start to manage that and improve it. So I think, you know, there's obviously a big education piece, but I think one of the ways that the argument will be made will be through, you know, what people call big data, and just sort of getting a lot more information out of these buildings and into sort of common knowledge.
Thank you, Don. You know, green technology didn't used to be about necessarily saving the environment. It was just another product to sell in a capitalist society. And you talk about the land side environmentalists and the energy side environmentalists. They aren't always on the same trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's really true. I think, there's some pretty stark examples of this. I mean, I think if you look at the 1980s wind industry, there were kind of true believers, right? I mean, people who felt like natural energy, renewable energy, you know, all the different ways that people used to describe it, solar energy, were like seriously, you know, important for the like soul of the nation. And then there were a lot of people who were just sort of like entrepreneurs. They were just like, mm-hmm. Hey, I'm a guy, I sell stuff. And at least in my mind, you kind of need both types. You need both types because in the history of green technology in America, there's been ups and there's been downs. And when there's an up, there's tons of entrepreneurs who rush in. And when there's downs, all those entrepreneurs rush out, and you need the true believers to keep the industry going. And in fact, there's been some work done by a guy named Gregory Nemeth at, there in Madison, looking at, you know, things that government can do to help smooth out that boom-bust cycle. And one of the big things, one of his big conclusions, is that whether a government or somebody else does it, it's in the down part of the cycle that the most good can be done. And that's because people end up, like in the 1980s wind industry, people end up leaving the industry if there are no jobs there. And with them goes all this kind of informal knowledge. You know, I think people think technology is, you know, are just kind of like you could just give someone the recipe and they can do it. But as anyone who's seen a good cook work, there's all these little things that they do that are really difficult to duplicate unless you have that person tell you how to do it. And that's what has happened many times in the U.S. with these alternative energy technologies is the people who really know what they're doing, when the industry goes belly up, they take off. And they go work in aerospace, or they go work in, you know, conventional internet technology jobs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lose all of this stuff. You basically have to start over the next time a green wave comes around. And so I think, you know, if there are two things that I know for sure from my history that I wish we kept people in during those down swings.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that companies that were supported by government money had to put more of their research and information into the public domain so that other people could work on it.
You know, I read in one interview with you that your book is about a series of failures.
yeah.
You know, but that's really, you know, as you said, it's just like the rest of everything there is about history of humankind and technology and so forth. And it gives some context for startups and some comeuppance to those among us who are so impatient with startups
kind
of dismissive of them. Well, it was the startups, you know, and a lot of the startups, you know, and it's just another startup.
Right, right.
Whatever I mean, it might be about.
I think people like to ignore, like, all the failures of history. But, you know, I mean, there are so many of them, it's almost mind-blowing in the technological realm. Even for the most successful technology entrepreneurs and technology people. I mean, even Steve Jobs had things that didn't work, right?
Yeah.
And he's sort of an icon. I mean, think of all the things Microsoft hasn't had work, and there's still Bill Gates. I mean, and then among entrepreneurs, the startup guys, I mean, so many of them fail. I mean, the mantra in Silicon Valley is fail faster, because they sort of figure if you're going to fail, you might as well do it quick.
Get it over with.
And that's an amazing, I mean, that's an amazing thing. I mean, it's one of the reasons to be excited, at least in my mind, that Silicon Valley has taken the interest that it has in green technology, because you kind of need a place that's like a little bit more okay with failure than we've traditionally been around energy technology in this country. Because the fact of the matter is lots of stuff isn't going to work. But you don't need lots of stuff to work. You need a few things to work, you know,
mm-hmm.
And you need some systemic change, and you need some, you know, changes in the behavior of people and changes in the behavior of companies. And you need, you know, there's all of these things that go into remaking the world so that there, you know, uses less energy and emits less carbon. But, you know, that means you got to throw a lot of things at the wall.
Sometimes I think that without cheap energy, which is how we got to the point where we're at now, there wouldn't be a Phoenix, Arizona. I lived there, and I can't imagine how it would have survived. But then again, then I read about the giant solar cell out in the deserts there and think, well, maybe they can sustain this going forward. It's hard to imagine how they can at the level that they're at now, given the cost and the increasing costs of fuel going forward.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, it's like a previous caller was saying about the buildings using, you know, radically less energy than the others. I mean, I think if we hadn't had a lot of cheap energy in this country, which, I mean, there are other countries in the world, and many of them don't have that, and they have different building techniques and ways of doing things, I think what you'd see is just that we'd put a lot more effort into making sure that buildings operate well. I mean, buildings use a huge chunk of the energy in the United States, you know, to heat and to light them and to provide them with electricity for computers and electronics. And I think that a lot of the time, people haven't put a lot of thought into how this is going to work. I mean, a great example is that some of the LEED Platinum buildings, you know, I mean, these are like kind of the most green buildings you can find.
Mm-hmm.
There were no operational processes for, do you want to keep the lights on 24 hours a day and things like that. And so as a result, some of those buildings have really underperformed in large part because the actual inside the building processes, ongoing things, haven't worked. I mean, the godfather of energy efficiency in this country is a guy named Art Rosenfeld, who works for the California Energy Commission. He was contributed to Nobel Prize in physics and like a brilliant guy. And he said that his sort of epiphany about energy was that, you know, at the national lab where he worked, they had a bunch of Europeans and they had a bunch of Americans. And all the Americans, where their light switch to turn the light off and on, had that blocked with bookshelves and desks and other things. And all the Europeans kept their that light switch easily accessible. And when he went around the room one Friday, all the Europeans had turned their lights off and all the Americans had their lights on. And that sort of cultural distinction that Americans have of being particularly wasteful when it comes to energy is not about comfort. It's not about convenience. It's just sort of like we never learned another way. And I think as time goes on, we're going to see that people, you know, figure that kind of thing out, and there are going to be smart thermostats that help them do that. There's going to be smart energy systems that help them do that. And eventually, I think you'll see our energy usage come more into line with, you know, the European countries or even Australia.
Susan and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome, Susan.
Hi. I just found the title of your book pretty interesting. I spent some time traveling around the Midwest a few years ago, and I was journaling, and I kept notes. I called it my log cabin project. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, I'd ask people at hardware stores, you know, poke around and see what kind of cranks and screws and mechanicals they had. And people had heard about what I was doing, and sometimes they'd give me ideas like ceiling fans that you could wind up. Or, you know, I was visiting old log cabins or historical homes to see, you know, what kind of things they used in the 19th century or so.
Wow.
And I just wanted to comment that one thing I noticed that was almost universally true was that in all these restored homes, the heating systems pretty much had been destroyed so that you couldn't really tell what they had done, you know, as far as designing a fireplace or anything like that. But I found that a lot of things could be done for almost no money at all, you know, like so many things are done so inefficiently, like the house I have myself is a suburban house of about 30 years old, and I tell people, you know, it was designed to use the maximum amount of energy possible.
That's right. It probably was.
And, you know, like I turned off my gas. I haven't had gas heat for like 3 years. And that means I have no hot water. And, you know, I sit around and somebody, I don't think it was my idea. It was somebody else. They said, why don't you get an old church coffee urn? You know, so you don't, if you want hot water upstairs, you can just plug in a coffee urn and use it once in a while. I mean, I don't know if people find that outrageously eccentric or not, but last...
I find it wonderfully eccentric. Does that count?
Okay. Yeah, he put a good spin on it, Susan. Thanks, Susan, for your call.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's interesting. I think I need hot water myself.
Me too.
But I also, but I appreciate the point. You know, I think, you know, people still lived great and full lives and fell in love with each other and had a great time, you know, before we used the level of electricity that we do now. And there are lots of ways of doing many things, and a lot of them come down to sort of what, you know, people sometimes call vernacular architecture. There's been some scholarship done on, you know, in particular, exactly the point that she made, that a lot of suburban homes were designed to use a lot of electricity intentionally. It was a really cheap way to build, and oftentimes the builders had relationships with people who put in electric systems and heating systems, these things, and also with local utilities. So sometimes utilities would, in effect, sponsor, almost like, you know, how Apple will give you a cheaper iPhone knowing that you're going to buy lots of apps and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or AT&T will give you the big discount, really. And when you look at that kind of configurations, it tends to drive a lot of consumption. And that's basically what happened with houses. I mean, we took what was smart design. Like, you know, you think of those old Southern houses with those, like, porches and mm-hmm. things. A lot of those things are beautiful. But it also was a way of reducing the amount of heat that would get into the house. And there's all sorts of things that you can do that just take energy and instead, you know, put design in.
Real quick, we're just about out of time, but you've made the point that the future of green technology is in how we conceive it. In other words, in how we involve computers and use them that way.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in like many of these things, like a lot of the improvements are going to come because we're able to find out new things using more data, using more computing power. And there's definitely a few circumstances where you can really see this kind of thing working. I mean, particularly around, again, materials, as I mentioned earlier in the mm-hmm. show. Being able to find new materials means better solar panels. It means, like, better thermoelectric devices. It means simulating wind turbines more effectively. I mean, it means all kinds of simulating buildings more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And all those things, you add them up, and I think it's going to make a difference.
Alexis Madrigal, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it, too.
Alexis Madrigal, he's the author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.